novel I'm writing called A Stone for Your Cairn. And it is the beginning, so you haven't missed any of the action, or any action you have missed, you're supposed to have missed. The girl was from Leeds, and it must have been in the news at the time, and for a long while after, but Anne cannot remember it at all. She heard about her on the radio on Monday. Amy Woodhouse, snatched as a toddler from a shopping centre, has been returned to her family. She has two new brothers who share what was her bedroom. Anne wonders what the parents said to her if they admitted that they stopped looking for her. The story is picking at the edges of memories Anne has distanced herself from. She has found ways of keeping things at arm's length, but news of this girl has slipped through, as water will find cracks in the smoothest rock face. For the first time since they built the cairn, she's been sleeping badly, hardly at all, sitting up all night smoking at the kitchen table with the wind raging round the stone cottage. She shakes the packet of cigarettes which lies on the kitchen table, more from habit than an expectation there will be any left. She will have to go to the village for more before Sadie arrives for her piano lesson at 10. She lifts her jacket from the peg and shuts the door quietly behind her, even though she is alone in the house. Overnight, the storm has passed, the clouds almost transparent now, a gauze curtain against the pale November sun. The lane down the hill to the village is empty of traffic and quiet, but for a single bird chirruping as if it's been left behind. Anne knows how he feels, but it's her habit to keep quiet. She fiddles with the lighter inside her pocket and coughs. In about half a mile, the lane turns and joins the main road to the village. She walks on the narrow pavement under the branches of the trees. Some leaves linger there, dried out and yellow. Behind her, the rumble of the bus approaches. It pulls up alongside the curb as she reaches the shop. The doors hiss open and she watches a solitary passenger step down. It's his first time in the village, she thinks. He's not dressed for hill walking, rather for visiting, in a blazer and jeans. The pavement outside the shop is a muddle of newspaper boards and ice cream signs around the bench, to which people are in the habit of tying their dogs when they go inside. The visitor sits down on the bench. He looks up at her as she passes, a jolt of recognition widening his eyes before he looks quickly away. She walks up the steps of the shop, has learned not to react to recognition over the years, not to connect with the unspoken questions people present. She sighs and pushes the door. The old-fashioned bell of Rini's father's era has been replaced by the monosyllabic blare, which is triggered by the pressure pad doormat. In spite of her expectation of it, the noise makes her jump. Rini is leaning over the counter, all 4'10" of her chest hoiked up, resting on her folded arms. "Well, Anne, back for mere fags, is it?" Strands of her purplish red hair have escaped from her bun and drizzle around the sides of her face. She bends, disappears momentarily, and Anne wonders if she should turn and run out of the shop, back up the lane to the cottage. But Rini appears and puts two cartons of cigarettes on the counter before she can move. Another shopper approaches the till, his back to Anne, so she walks quickly down the aisle. Pausing between the towering shelves, she looks blankly around. Biscuits. She can buy some biscuits for Sadie, but there are so many brands and she can't remember the sort that children like. So she reaches for any packet rather than delving into memories which have settled, the deep, calm sediment at the bottom of her soul, which, when stirred up, causes everything to become murky and terrifying. She reaches the end of the aisle, pauses by the magazine rack and listens to the beeping of the cash register and the high-pitched drone of Rini's voice. On the floor, piles of newspapers lie in a neat row, the covers showing the same photo of the man, Raymond Feldman, being hustled from a police van. His bald head appears to be receding into his shoulders. He is wearing a navy blue jumpsuit, holding his two arms clasped together in front of him. Anne scans the headlines. He kept her locked in a room for 8 years. One paper is a photo of the girl sitting between her parents, eyes downcast. Anne reaches down and grabs a Herald and walks to the counter with it. The man is still standing by the till, arms folded, one leg in front of the other as he watches Rini slowly ring up and place each item into a plastic bag. She is holding him hostage. He turns and nods at Anne and she recognises him as the new farmer, Aidan something. Not so new anymore, she realises. "I'll be with you in a wee minute, Anne," Rini keeps her pace and turns back to Aidan. Aye, well, it's unbelievable. You'd think someone would have seen her. Someone would have noticed living not 20 miles from where she was taken. I mean, she stops and clutches at her chest with a chubby hand. Och, Anne, Hen, well. She looks back to the basket, empty now of Aidan's shopping, and presses a final button on the till. 12.80, please, pet. Aidan fishes around in his jeans and hands her a 20. The clock behind Rini ticks loudly. Can I settle up when I come in next? Anne asks, reaching for the cigarette. Aye, no bother. Rini smiles, yellow teeth at her. Anne turns to Aidan, who is also smiling, but in a different way, to himself. He kicks at something unseen at his foot and gives a small shake of his head. She smokes two cigarettes on the walk home and stops when she reaches the lane to look in the paper. He kept her locked in her room. One day, the girl stole some matches and set fire to her mattress. Anne wonders where she found the matches. According to the paper, the girl was going to sit in the room with the egg boxes on the walls as it burned. But the smoke forced her out of the window. She jumped from the first floor. When asked what she'd done all day, Amy responded that she'd watched television. Would she have learned about fire and escape on television? How would she have known how her life should have been any different? It is not yet clear, according to the paper, the extent to which he mistreated her. The sun is coming out as Anne approaches the cottage, spilling yellow light into the garden, but behind the house, dark clouds are gathering on the hills, and she can see thin strips of rain trailing down onto the horizon. Fat drops of rain land on the path as she opens the gate. Sadie is sitting, curled round the step like a comma. Her red sweatshirt echoes that of the rainbow which is forming over the hills. Anne almost points it out to the sullen child. Why did you not go in, Sadie? The girl looks down. Her neat brown bob falls forward over her face, and she shrugs as if she's trying to release herself from loosely tied ropes. After the lesson, Anne retreats to the kitchen, tired of the strain she feels teaching the child, of curbing her impatience. She wonders when she changed or if she was always this way. Whatever had helped her to position their cold little fingers on the correct keys has disappeared long ago. Now only Sadie remains of the children she once taught, a favour to the girl's father. She thinks that perhaps she had her own reasons to take her in, to watch her and see if she might grow into someone Anne recognises. From the kitchen, Anne hears the clunking of the pedals of the piano, then keys played too quickly as Sadie practices her scales. The child cannot reach the pedals of the piano if she sits on the stool. Anne fills a glass with orange cordial and freezing water from the tap and walks through the small hall and into the living room. Sadie is standing on the pedals as she plays, lifting her feet one then the other like a marionette. She can see Sadie's eyes move quickly to the door, sensing Anne's presence. She sits back down on the stool and her little fingers move more slowly and deliberately over the keys, changing to the entertainer, played slowly, a ridiculous version sounding as if it comes from a broken music box. She dips her little head dramatically with every note, then plays an incorrect note, C-sharp, that hurts Anne's teeth and she says deadpan, no. Sadie nods vigorously but keeps playing, her shoulders moving now as she makes her way to the end of the piece. Anne places the glass on the coffee table, watches Sadie finish in the flourish of splayed fingers over the keys. Her pinky appears close to slipping, but she keeps her eyes closed for a solemn moment, then twists on the mahogany stool and walks back round the sofa, sits quietly in its faded expanse. She takes a drink from the glass, keeps the rim in her mouth as she swallows, then breathes heavily. Mrs. McLennan, Sadie looks up from the glass. Anne does not believe Sadie uses her family name to maintain a formal air. She uses it because it is Sadie's own name too. She draws it out, ponders it, as if it's the first time she's come across her own reflection in the mirror. Yes, Sadie. What's anal? Anne is surprised by her own laughter then, the sound of it filling the room like a wave that washes far beyond the shoreline. Sadie looks down into her glass of juice. Anne clears her throat and straightens out her smiling face. Where did you hear that word? I don't want to say. Her little pink lips are pursed as if to prove her discretion. Well, it's to do with your bum. Sadie's eyebrows disappear behind her fringe. But it depends on the context. I would need to know who said it and when and why to be able to explain it properly. Oh. She pauses and appears to consider whether it's worth revealing her source. My mum said my dad was it. Anne imagines Finlay and his new wife arguing. She takes some pleasure from this. Or perhaps it was a joke. His wife was teasing him, rubbing her hands through his greying hair. She realises the child is looking to her, waiting for her translation of the argument. Ugh, it just means your dad's a fusspot and likes his things just so. Can I use the loo, Mrs. McLennan? She asks after a short pause. Again, Sadie. Aha, okay. Anne takes the half-empty glass back to the kitchen in case more to drink will encourage Sadie in her investigation of Anne's chilly bathroom. She's nothing much for the girl to explore. Sadie's mother must keep a far more interesting arsenal of toiletries than bleach and some co-op shampoo. Upstairs, the toilet flushes and Anne sits listening for the sounds of the floorboards as Sadie comes slowly downstairs. She gives a start as the child cries out, then tumbles down the stairs. The sounds of a scuffle and a thump make Anne feel like laughing again. Sadie rests partially on the bottom step, one arm thrown dramatically across her face, covering her eyes as if she fears what looking might reveal. Anne waits to see if she will start crying, and it seems as though Sadie is also waiting to see what Anne will do. Come on, up you get, Anne mutters as she lifts herself from the sofa. Sadie lifts her arm from her face and her eyes narrow as if Anne is to blame for this mishap. Nothing's broken now. Anne bends and takes the child's hands, pulls her to her feet. How do you know? Sadie snatches her hands away from Anne and holds her wrist protectively. Anne had meant nothing and the house was broken. Sit down, Sadie. Would you like a biscuit? The child's lip protrudes slightly now, with a sign of kindness. She nods and retreats to the sofa. In the kitchen, Anne leans on the faded oak worktop and lifts the packet of biscuits from where they lie on the newspaper, turns the page to the interview with the mother of Amy Woodhouse. Sadie has wandered into the kitchen. Can I call my mum, please? I think she's late. Anne checks her watch and nods to Sadie, passes her a biscuit from the packet. You remember the number? Aye, I'm 7. She huffs out of the room, and while the house is filled with the rattle of the telephone dial, Anne turns back to the paper. The girl has been to the hospital and been declared in perfect health. She visited the dentist, who said he had never seen such healthy teeth. Apparently, Feldman had been giving the child fluoride tablets. Anne reads and rereads this. It does not make sense to her. The article is forgiving of Amy's parents, who carried on with their lives, made more children to take Amy's place. Anne thinks of Finlay and his new family, Sadie and his American wife. The receiver is replaced with a ping, and Sadie sighs. Not there. Anne feels a hardening in her stomach, the heavy resentment she felt towards Finlay now directed at Amy's parents. How could they have deserved this? Their daughter returned to them while they did nothing. We never stopped hoping, the mother said. They never stopped hoping. Anne looks out of the window up into the glen. The rain is falling heavily now, drumming on the skylight of the small kitchen. The silence in the cottage feels vulnerable as the wind picks up. She can feel it as it slips through the cracks in the woodwork around the windows. Anne grips the edge of the worktop, allows the cold to accuse her as she looks to her old accomplice, the black cairn which stands in the gully above the cottage. She imagines how the wind passes through the gaps in the grey slate as it makes its way towards her. Whereas the cairn was once something of a comfort to her, it is beginning to change. It is beginning to turn on her. Mrs. McLennan, there's a man at your gate. He can't open it. He can't work the latch. Sadie sounds incredulous. Anne walks through, and when she sees the man who stepped off the bus that morning, she is not surprised. Somehow, she has been waiting for him.